Blog Talk Radio. Hi, this is Marnie Svedberg, and I welcome you to Marnie and Friends, a place where leaders share practical, helpful, and encouraging ways to get anything important done faster, better, and smarter. Right now, I encourage you to sit back, buckle up, and join us for fun, laughter, practical help, and clear thinking, the kind of discussion that focuses our attention off of the fluff and onto the most important stuff in life. Again, welcome to Marnie's Friends. Let's get going. Everybody, welcome back to another edition of Marnie's Friends. So excited to have you along this afternoon and really excited to be here with you to talk about a subject that we all don't like to talk about, making sense when life doesn't. Our guest today, Cecil Murphy, is a man who stimulates minds and nourishes souls, as he is the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, 90 Minutes in Heaven, as well as over 100 other books. He's brought hope to millions by being honest about life's cluttered disorganization, and he's here to share with us today how to make sense when life doesn't, which is also the name of his new book, Making Sense When Life Doesn't. Welcome, Cecil.
Hey, Marnie, thank you so much for having me as your guest.
Well, thank you for being here. I can't even tell you how excited I am about interviewing you today, because this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I'm a success coach, a success coach trainer, and one of the things that people ask me is, how can you be a success coach trainer when you've lived through fires and floods and a tornado and a burglary and a lightning strike and head injury in the family and cancer in the family and car wrecks and boat sinking and all these things that happen in a life, and yet I teach success strategies and they're like, that does not spell success. That looks like failure.
That's why you can do it, because you've been there.
Exactly. I'm so excited for you to share with us what you have learned. And, you know, Cecil, I think the reason why I'm most excited to interview you today is because, as the author and co-author of over 100 books, including the book 90 Minutes in Heaven, which, by the way, I love that book.
Thank you.
You have really been up close and personal with a lot of people who've had amazingly difficult scenarios in their lives. And yet they've been God lovers, and they have been loving God maybe even at the time that the tragedies happened to them. And so I'm so excited for you to share with us the perspective that you've gained over the years of interviewing these people and working with them.
Well, and part of it is, you know, like you, Marnie, I've lived a bit too.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. No, we all have. We all have.
Yeah, but, you know, the problem is a lot of people don't take advantage of their crises. That's one of the things I talk about, is that, hey, life is full of crises.
Yeah. And when you say take advantage of our crises, tell us what you mean by that.
Well, you know, see, I think life, God gave us this life to learn, to grow. And as a Christian, I can honestly say that God's purpose for me is to make me more and more like Jesus Christ. And the only way I know that that's going to happen is to go through some difficult times, struggle through them, and come out on top. People who want, expect, and pray for the easy life just don't make it.
In what way don't they make it?
Well, that's probably not the right way to say it. They don't make that triumphant level of growth. They don't reach the place where people like you and I do, where we know that life is wonderful and marvelous. But it's because we've had to pay the price, and because we've paid the price, we know how wonderful it is.
We've got, listeners, we have a download for you that we've created, a worksheet, a handout, and you can follow along with us on there. The first point you make, Cecil, is that messes are just part of life. And talk to us about why you think life has to be so messy.
Well, that's just the way it works. You know, we in the church particularly, we think, wow, God is there to protect us, to take care of us. We never have to have any real serious problems because we got God on our side. And when these disruptions, or whatever you want to call them, I call them the IB, the inevitable bumps, when they come, then we don't know what to do. See, here's the way I say it. I serve a God of presence and not a God of protection. I serve a God who's with me all the time. He doesn't protect me from the hardships of life. And those hardships are the messes, the crises that we all face.
I've said it a different way for years, but I think we're saying the same thing. I've always said that protection is, you know, God says that he protects us in the Bible, but it's all about definition, isn't it? His definition doesn't look like ours.
Well, yeah, and you look at the protection, though. It's usually to the Jewish nation or to a group, but, you know, think of Psalm 23:4. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, thou art with me. And Isaiah talks about going through the waters, the fire, he's there with us. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. It's not that we won't have those things. It's that we will have his presence. Or like the Hebrew boys in the fire, he's there with us.
He didn't keep them from the fire. He kept them in the fire.
That's right.
Yeah. Where did we get so confused about this as a culture, as a Christian, you know, people? Well, how did we lose our way here?
I don't know, except that I think that one of the things as Christians, particularly in a culture we live in where it's so anti-Christian, is that we keep talking about peace and joy and happiness and all, and that's all true. I remember one time I went through a whole string of difficult times that I laughingly said, if I'd known what the Christian life was going to be like, I wouldn't have signed on, because I really didn't mean that. But I think we try to convince people that just life, just Christian life, is just full of joy and peace. And it is, but we forget that there's something else, that God is with us through those very, very difficult times.
In your book, you have a quote at the end of chapter one, life is messy. I can't avoid the chaos, but I can choose my response to the crisis. And that's really the bottom line, isn't it?
Well, sure, you know, and I see this all the time. People, they give up, or it's, why me? Why did God pick me out? My answer is, well, why not you, you know?
If you could think,
what I've learned to do is every time I hit these bad spots, and we all do, and I still hit them, it's like, okay, God, I don't ask God why. I say, okay, God, what is the lesson I need to learn from this experience?
And even, I know there's a lot of people that feel like you won't hit them unless you're doing something wrong, but my experience and the experience that I've seen in life is that that's true. I mean, honestly, sometimes we get ourselves into trouble, but a lot of times you hit them because you're doing something right.
Well, sure, right. Yeah, and you know, if we're always looking for causes, that's not an answer. Suppose you said to God, okay, God, I've got a broken leg. I want to know why you're giving this broken leg, and God says, okay, here are three reasons why your leg is broken, but you know what, your leg's still broken. So
right.
Even if you know the reason, it doesn't change anything. But what you can do is say, okay, God, I got the broken leg, I'm sorry, tell me what I need to learn from this experience.
Right, or here we are, so what are we going to do?
Yeah,
it's so true. You say, you teach people that every hardship prepares us for the next one. That's kind of a interesting way to think about it.
Well, it only if we choose to let it do that happen, you know. But, you know, what I saw was when my mother was 80 years old, my father died and my older brother died on the day of his funeral.
Wow.
My brothers and sisters were absolutely devastated. And they didn't know and they said, who's going to tell Mom? Who's going to tell Mom? And I said to them, hey, how do you think she got to be 80 years old? She can handle this. So they made me go tell her, which I did. And she said, okay. Mm-hmm. She got alone. She stayed alone and prayed for maybe an hour. She came back out and she was fine. She said, you know, it has to happen.
Wow.
And that's where life is.
It is. It is. Sometimes I've heard people say, you know, God promises he won't give us more than we can handle, but it looks like he just did give that person more than they could handle.
Well, you know, I don't know how to even want to say it that way. I mean, I don't really hear it a lot, and while I believe in it's true, that isn't the point. It isn't how much we get. It's what do we learn from this? And, you know, life is meant to be learning. And it says of Jesus, though he were a son, yet he learned obedience by the things he suffered.
Yeah. He was never done learning,
and
even though he was
God. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there's no easy way there's no easy way to be a victor, because you have to fight to become an overcomer.
Yeah. Right. And we tend to like the easy road. We tend to like the
smooth. Of course. I don't want to. Hey, come on. Anytime I get a choice, I'll take the easy way. But But the reality is, if we really want to be everything Jesus Christ wants us to be, we'll go the hard road.
I have a way of saying it, Cecil, that I'm either on the front line fighting, or else I'm in the barracks taking a little break. And I really like the breaks.
Well, that's true. Yeah, you know, the way I see this, you know, my life right now is very calm. But I know in a day, week, it'll get chaotic again, and that's the way life is. And I'm, you know, the more I realize this pattern in life, the more I say, okay, God, bring it on, because I'm going to learn from this.
What is one of the most difficult stories that you've heard, as far as just when you heard it, you thought, oh, wow, that one's really almost over the top, even for me?
I think when I've heard the stories of somebody who's not only lost, for instance, in a fire, lost everything they've owned, lost family members, and then later, one story in particular, later on they found out it was the daughter, teenage daughter, who set the house on fire and was therefore responsible for the death of five people. I mean, that you just, it's overwhelming. And yet, by the way, eventually she's spending her life in prison, but eventually she did become a believer, faced her sin. But it's a horrendous story.
See, so one of the things that I struggle with when I'm going through, especially when I'm just on the outside edge kind of a trauma, so either a family member is going through something extremely painful or a very close friend is kind of touching me but not directly touching me. In those situations, I have a really hard time to balance what is loving compassion and what is worry and what's my role. You know, when it's just happening to me, I can usually just run to Jesus with that and get on with it, you know, much more easily than I can when it's happening to one of my children or to my husband. Or what do you do when you're in those situations where something really nasty is happening to somebody very close to you?
Well, the first thing I suggest is don't give them advice. Don't try to give them a lot of comfort. You know, I think the one thing that I hear, and this is the one thing that makes it so difficult for me, these people coming through Bible verses at me, and I believe in the Bible, you understand that, but they throw these Bible verses. Finally, I got to the point where I started saying to people, okay, if you've experienced those verses, you may share them with me, but if you haven't experienced them, don't give them to me. See, I do believe that all things work together for good, and I believe all these promises they give me, but, you know, there's a time for it. And I think when we really care, we're really sensitive, we don't throw those kinds of things at people because we're too touched by their pain. What they need from us in the beginning, I believe, is just to be there and let them know we care.
Yeah, just some compassion.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you have another kind of interesting approach to things. You say that we need our enemies. Why do you say that we need enemies?
Well, okay, as I also said, if you don't like the word enemies, try opponents or people who are, you know, disagree with us. And we don't even have to seek them. They'll find us. So don't worry about it. You've got them. But, you know, right? I actually call them my grace builders. But these are the people who really tell us the truth. You know, I have friends who really love me, and they know my weaknesses, but you say, if I say something, they'll say, oh, well, that's just the way you are. You know, they're so loving and so accepting. I may be overbearing or, you know, whatever the problem may be, but they accept that because they love me. But our opponents, those other people, are really pretty apt to just tell us off. Let me give you an example. There was a woman who yelled at me and told me, said to me, you always have to be right. I get so tired of you. You always have to be right. And I laughingly said, well, when you are, you know, that's if you're either. But later on, I thought about it, and you know what? She was right. I really, not totally, but one of the things that was one of the things she said, and I realized that was an important thing to me, to be right. And when I finally was able to say, hey, God, I don't have to be right. And it took, and that wasn't easy. Please don't misunderstand that. But once I realized I didn't have to be right, it just gave me such a wonderful freedom. And I could say to somebody, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. And what I discovered is that people respected me more for my honesty than for always having the answer.
Yeah. There's a lot of freedom in just seeing ourselves as God sees us, isn't there?
Oh, sure. And you know, when I can honestly say I don't know, then it also takes the responsibility off me to prove that I'm right.
Right. Well, this is Marnie Swedberger visiting today with Cecil Murphy. He's the co-author of 90 Minutes in Heaven. He's also the author of a new book called Making Sense When Life Doesn't. We're going to come right back and talk a little bit about how trials help us discern our true passions. We'll be right back. Have you added your women's Bible study yet to www.BibleStudyExpo.com? It's free, it's easy, and it makes it possible for new believers and gals who are new to your community to find you and your women's Bible study. So go to www.BibleStudyExpo.com and add your women's Bible study today. Successfully maximizing the gifts God has given us is the best gift that we can give back to God. Are you 100% clear about why you're here, about how God defines success for you personally? Are you on track with God's plan for your life, the best life on planet Earth followed by the best possible eternity for you? If not, check out the Success Principles Intensive Training course over at Marnie.com. It's a 6-hour online program that will change how you define and do your life from today forward. It's a biblically based approach to goal setting and achievement. So check it out under the training tab at Marnie.com. Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back. This is Marnie Swedberg, and I'm so excited that you could join us this afternoon for our interview with Cecil Murphy, the author of a new book called Making Sense When Life Doesn't. And Cecil has actually co-authored or written over 100 books. His website is cecilmurphy.com, which is CecilMurphy.com. Cecil, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, Marty, you're fun to talk to.
Oh, well, thank you. You too. And you're fun to read, man.
Okay. We like each other, don't we?
What has been your favorite book to write so far? The writing process itself.
I guess I'd have to go back and say this one and of my own. I do all kinds of different things. I do caregiving books and so on. This is the most honest and vulnerable I know how to be. But I make most of my money as a collaborator, ghostwriter for other people. And probably the most delightful book was a book I did in 1992 that is still in print and still sells well. It's called Gifted Hands, the Dr. Ben Carson story.
Huh.
They made a movie out of it with Cuba Gooding Jr. And he was just so wonderful, delightful to work with. So, you know, I really haven't had any bad books.
Aw, that's awesome.
For others.
Yeah. And now when you said this one, you're talking about making sense when life doesn't.
I'm sorry. Yes, making sense.
Yeah.
Because a publisher came to me, Summerside, which is now owned by Guidepost. They came to me and they just said, tell us what your heart is. What do you really want to write about? And I told them, and they didn't like my title, Making Sense When Life Doesn't. I said, okay, here's another title, Life is Messy. And so if you look at the book, on the back it says Life is Messy. But they probably decided they like my title better. But you know, that's the point of my growth. I'm still learning, and I find that so many people, especially in this down economy, divorce rates are high. People are losing their homes. Downsides. I have two editor friends just yesterday with publishing house got downsized.
Yeah,
which means they were put out. Not because they weren't good, it's just that the economy's down. So, you know, why us? Why those people? Well, that's just the way life is. Life is full of these kind of crazy things.
What do you say to the Christian who says, but I thought God was going to protect me from all these things?
Well, see, and I think that's that false thinking. God does protect you in that God is with you. And nothing more is going to happen to you than God allows. Look at the story of Job. But, you know, think of it this way instead, Marnie. ask themselves, what is going on that makes you need this thing in your life? Now, you don't. I don't ask them if they're really, really a deep pit. That's not the time to ask. But when they've clawed out, or at least halfway out of the pit, and you say to them, you know, you really had a rough time from this. What did you learn from it? Why did you need to go into that pit?
You know, Cecil, there was a situation that I was close to probably 15 years ago now. And a few years ago, it ended up that the person left their position in ministry very broken, very sad. A few years ago, some people from the ministry went on a trip, and this person and their wife was on the trip with them. And one of them said to the man, they said, you know, looking back, what can you see that God brought good out of that? And his answer, Cecil, was nothing. I can see nothing good. And it was so heartbreaking because, you know what, most of the time Christians are really on the lookout for what we can see that God did good through that. And it's possible that that still isn't apparent. But oftentimes in my life and in the lives of the people that I've watched go through terribly hard times, even from almost the beginning, they can see God's hand.
Okay. I think that's absolutely true. And it's sad when people don't learn.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I think that's a good story because I think it's true with a lot of people. You know, God tells us not to harden our heart, talks against being stiff-necked. And I think, and I don't know the person, so I'm glad I don't, because, you know, if there's always a lesson to learn from these hard times. I look at the times. All right, let me give you an example. My house burned down in 2005. I lost everything, including my son-in-law, which was really very painful. But several things happened. Number one, I said to my best friend, you know what, I've been preparing for this. And by that I meant I had enough things in the past that when this happened, I wasn't thrown apart. I wasn't devastated. I didn't like it, but I could handle it. The second thing I said to him, you know what, I can start over again. I can redefine my life. Now, and I really meant that. I got to start over. I got a new house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and other. I don't mean that materially particularly, but I mean it was a chance for me to look at my life and say, okay, everything's wiped away. Where do I go now? And I had choices, wonderful choices. A couple of them I probably would not have made if I hadn't gone through the devastation.
And I think this comes back to my greatest struggle, Cecil, is, you know, okay, so you lost your son-in-law in that fire. So how do you, because I'm really right with you there. I'm like, okay, we have lost this now. When my dad died, it took me less than 3 minutes. We walked from the building to the vehicle where we were going to go and drive to where he had just laid down on the garage floor and died, just a sudden mm-hmm. death. And by the time we walked from the building to the vehicle, I said to my husband, I said, wow, you know, if he's really dead, so, okay, that statement says I'm still a little in shock here, but if he's really dead, then that means that God let him go home in the exact way he wanted, because he wanted to never have to suffer and prolong suffering and actually be a burden to other people. That was always my dad's prayer, is that he could not be a burden to other people. And I thought, you know, if he laid down in the garage and died, then that means that God gave him exactly what he wanted. And right within 3 minutes, I was able to find something to be grateful about. But Cecil, sometimes, like when you've lost a son-in-law or when I've lost my father, sometimes that gratitude is perceived by others as insensitivity or a lack of sadness, a lack of loss. And of course, I absolutely felt the loss of my father, and I grieved for him like anybody would. But there's a way to go through this, and I look in the scripture where it says we don't grieve as the world grieves without hope.
That's right.
And that's where I have the difference. Where do you do the balance there?
Well, several things I would say. First, we live in this Western culture where we think we have to get an answer from God for everything that happens. And where does God have to be answerable to us? He is the Lord, the Master. We know that when we're in dire distress. And then we turn around and say, okay, God, tell me what's going on here. You know, God doesn't owe me anything. And think about Job for a minute. When he was going through all of that, you know, he was so busy fighting his battles, he didn't look for, he did ask a few questions. But, you know, the main thing is, that's God's business. I can't ask, I have no right to demand God to explain anything to me. Sometimes I understand, sometimes I don't. But my faith is such that I can say, you know, even though these things happen, I am still able to trust him. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. So I think that's the first thing. And the second thing is that, you know, bad things really happen, and devastating. But let me tell you this, Marnie. After your father died, I suspect you're much more sensitive to other people in their loss.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Then you have learned something, haven't you?
Right, right. Yeah.
See, that's what life is. Yeah. You know, we learn it not just for ourselves, but learn it to pass on to someone
right.
else.
Right. And the way that you say that is so beautiful, Cecil, because you didn't say, your father died because God thought you needed to learn something.
No. God didn't tell me that. No, I don't know why. I don't know the reason for any of these things. But I do know that once they happen, I can say, okay, now what are the lessons I need to learn? How can I grow from this so that I can reach out and pass it on to other people?
Mm-hmm. So beautiful. You know, when you were talking there about asking God why, I remember one day I was just fed up, and it was like God was not coming through on his promises. God was not doing his side of the deal as far as my perspective. And I got really, really, really upset. And I went into my room and I shut the door and I was pacing back and forth. I'm like, God, you've got to talk to me. Where are you? What are you doing? I think you're just lying to me. And of course, you know, we know Jeremiah said that at one point.
Sure.
God, I think you've deceived me. You know,
sure.
Other people have felt this way. And I just thought, God, you just have to speak to me. And a verse came into my mind, and it was James 4:14. And I thought, gosh, you know, God, you're always taking me to James 4:10, which is humble yourselves. But this is not James 4:10. I don't have a clue what James 4:14 says. And I was so curious. And I opened my Bible, and I had the Amplified version. And Cecil, here's what it says. You do not know the least thing. And it was hilarious because that just was like a knife. It was like this hilarious knife to my heart. And I just burst out laughing, and I thought, you are so right. I do not know the least thing. And, in fact, I walked out of my room, and every member of my family I saw, I said, I don't know anything. I just want you to know I don't know anything. And God knows I don't know anything. And I was just so – it was so funny. But, you know, God does know that we don't need to know everything and that we don't get how he works.
And that's liberating. See, you don't have to explain God to anything, anybody. See, all you have to do is to say, okay, I trust you, God.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really all he wants. And with Job, you know, he was really clear about that. You know, do you actually know how all this works, Job? Are you really clear about how all this works? Because as soon as you're clear about how all of the being God thing works, then you and I can talk, you know, the way you wanting to.
Yeah. And you know, there's also something with the story of Job, but I think people often miss on that. Job was a little bit self-righteous, and God had to take him apart. If you look at chapter 38, he said, okay, Job, you're so smart. Where were you when I created this world?
Yeah. And yet we go back to Job chapter 1, and in his self-righteousness, if we want to call it that, and in his maybe fearfulness that something bad is going to happen, if we worry maybe we want to call it, in all that, God still says he is a righteous man.
Oh,
he
absolutely.
Loves me,
sure.
And he's doing great. And that's really, you know, that's really the person that got whammed is the person who was really doing great with God.
I'm just going to say, it's like this, you're a parent. Somebody comes and attacks your child, tells you how awful your child is. You're very defensive. This is my child. I love this child. This child is perfect. When you're alone with the child, you can see some of the things that he or she does wrong, but your love covers it. Well, that's how I see God.
Yeah, for sure. Through Jesus. So awesome. I want us to keep going down because we got people here with these notes.
Okay, sorry.
That's okay. We're having a blast here. Number four, I just love, it's that struggles help us discern our passion. Talk a little bit about how did you discover that, or how did you arrive? I love this principle.
Well, I so often we don't know what our passion is. We take the way that we think is the easy way or the normal way. Joseph Campbell was on public TV. He said most people take the right-handed path, which is the prudent path, and you follow it and you climb the ladder of success. But when you get to the top, you sometimes discover it's against the wrong wall. But the other hand, the left-handed path is a lot riskier. You don't know where it's going to go, but it's also the path of bliss. Now, let me give you an example. I was a pastor for 14 years and 6 years as a missionary before that. I loved what I did. It was wonderful. Then I began to write. Then I had this identity crisis. Did I want, was I a writer who preached or a preacher who wrote? And I had to find out what my passion was. And here's what I finally said. If I stayed a pastor the rest of my life, my working life, would I be satisfied? And that's when I realized, you know what? No. I would rather be a writer. And that's when I discovered the real deep passion of my life.
And you're so good at it. So we're so glad you did.
Thank you. Well, thank you.
You know, I just used this, actually, this principle, I just used it with a leader I was working with yesterday that was telling me about, he had a change in office situations, and the person that they, the people they were now sharing office space with had very kind of sloppy work habits, come late, leave early, chit-chat through the day, you know, whatever, and he was holding his team to kind of a higher standard. They had a lot of work to get done, and they were doing great until they got in this environment, and now he was the bad guy. And I said, you know, this is a great opportunity for you to decide who you are and what's really important to you. And then
that's
you
right.
can, and you know what? That's exactly what he did. And I love this, that struggles are often the time that help us to clarify what really our values are, what we're really willing, you know, like a parent would say, what hill you're willing to die on, you know?
Yeah.
Now, number five is don't refer to lack of achievement as failures. Consider them tiny steps towards success. That keeps us trying. What are some examples of that?
Well, I think the Olympics. These people won the gold medal. They didn't make it the first time. In the book, I tell the story about I was a smoker when I became a believer. I'm an adult convert. And I tried and tried and tried for months to quit smoking. And everything I tried didn't work. And then one day, and I prayed about it, of course, and one day it just, I didn't need it anymore.
Right.
And I think that sometimes we have to find ways that don't work before we find out the ways that do. And it's not just that, Marnie, it's also the fact that if we keep struggling, it tells us how badly we want something. Jesus told a parable about importuning, begging God. Well, it's the same kind of thing. If we don't really want something, we won't keep asking. We'll quit very early.
Yeah. I like the definition of failure that failure is feedback. Failure just means you've received a little bit of an additional information now about the situation, and then you have a choice what to do with that feedback. But, you know, and the other thing is I think sometimes the bar is set so high that you can't do anything but fail. You know, you think about the Olympics, how many in each category, how many people got a gold medal?
That's right.
One.
Yeah. But, you know, and the point is that even those who didn't get it kept trying. My friend Jeff Adams says, demand perfection, but settle for excellence.
Demand perfection, settle for excellence.
Let's settle for excellence.
Yeah. And I think too, before God, you know, my definition of success, and this is what I teach in the coach certification training that I do, Cecil, is that success is loving the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, and loving my neighbor as myself. And if that's the definition of success for my life, then every night when I go to bed and I say, how is it with me today? And I'm asking God, how is it with me today? And you know what? That night, every night, I have the opportunity for him to say, well done, my good and faithful servant, or for him to say, you know what? We've got a few things we need to talk about today. and it can go either way. But it allows me the freedom and the joy and the success of being a success every single day of my life. I don't have to wait until I have a gold medal to feel like I've accomplished something.
And you don't have to let other people define success for
right.
you.
Right.
So I think we live in a culture that unless we have the best grades or or our son is a doctor or, you know, we got the biggest house on the street or something, we're not successful. Hey, those are really side issues. You have to define success in your relationship to God. That's what's important.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is Marnie Swedberg. We're visiting today with Cecil Murphy. He's the author of a new book called Making Sense When Life Doesn't. We're going to come right back and talk about how we release the old definition, the old goals, the old perceptions that we have so we can move into the new. We'll be right back. Do you carry a few extra pounds around than you'd like? Are you sick to death of dieting? Or maybe sick of resisting the urge to diet because every time you try, you gain back more than you lost? Check out eatingwithgod.com. That's eatingwithgod.com. It's the easiest, most obvious, and most powerful non-dieting approach to weight management that you'll ever find. Starting today, you can enjoy every bite eating with God. Learn more at eatingwithgod.com. Do you ever need speakers for dinners, retreats, conferences, or other women's events? Check out www.womenspeakers.com. It's the largest online directory of Christian women speakers in the world, featuring over 1,500 Christian women speakers, some near you, and some from every level of experience and fee range you can imagine. So you're sure to find lots of great speaker options for you and your next event over at www.womenspeakers.com. That's womenspeakers.com. Well, hi, welcome back. This is Marnie Swedberg, and I am so delighted that you've taken a few minutes out of your busy day to learn how to make sense when life doesn't. Our guest today, Cecil Murphy, is sharing with us some of the information in his new book, Making Sense When Life Doesn't. And also, he has a wonderful website about all of his books and what he shares, the message that he shares over at cecilmurphy.com. Cecil, let's talk a little bit about how come we need to release the old in order to make room for the new.
Well, think about it. You know, people want to move on to the new phase of life, but they really don't want to let go of the old. It's like the old may be horrible, but it's familiar. And I think we not only need to let go, I think we need some empty spaces. By that I mean, okay, let's say a marriage is over. You can sit there and complain about how, oh, I really didn't want the divorce or whatever, you know, or why did I put up with it for 20 years, whichever side you're on. And you can feel sorry for yourself and stay there. And too many men don't have that empty space, for instance. They will quickly grab another woman because they can't stand being alone. And I as a pastor, I used to see this all the time. And I think what we need is to say, okay, that part of my life is over. I'm going to accept what is and even feel sorry for myself for a little bit. I think there's nothing wrong with a little self-pity for a short time. Then when I've sort of gotten that, then I'm ready to move on. But you just don't jump from the old while you're still holding on. I'm sorry, jump to the new while you're still holding on to the old. It doesn't work.
I like the story of, I think it was a chimpanzee who was holding on to a coconut or something that he had, and he was trying to move from one space into the other. And, of course, he could make it through, but not with that in his hand. And how,
right.
You know, that's how we are. We kind of clutch these things, even though we know we want to move into the new space where God is preparing a new thing for us. But we really, I call it status quo, where everything about us, all of our subconscious force is trying to keep the status quo. Just keep it stable. Don't change. Don't give up what's comfortable, even if it's miserable, like you said. And it's so true. But leaving an empty space, that's true. That's just a rule that applies. An empty space will be filled. And if we aren't careful, it's filled too quickly. And if we don't make an empty space, pretty tough to fill in.
Yeah, and you know, these people who jump into a new relationship with another person or a job or when they haven't really resolved the issues of the old, they're not really in a new relationship. They're just redoing the old one.
Hmm. do you have any kind of a process that you personally go through when you're moving, transitioning? Do you have like a mental paradigm that you adopted that's helped you?
Well, actually, I do. When something like that, you know, is over, something changes, you may laugh, but I actually say to myself, hey, it's okay to feel sorry for myself for a while. Sometimes it's half an hour, sometimes it's half a day, but just, you know, sit there with a little self-pity, feel regret over how a situation ended, and then when I've done, you know, groveled a bit, then I say, okay, now it's time to look at the new and move on. But, see, I think we tend to want to rush into the new without feeling the pain or the rejection or whatever. I call it self-pity, but sometimes that means the pain, the rejection, the loss. And until we deal with what we no longer have, I don't think we're really quite ready to reach out to what's ahead.
Yeah. I've heard that before, and it's nice that you rephrased that a little bit too, because like for me personally, I can't do self-pity. Self-pity to me is the mother of all kinds of nasty stuff in my life.
Self-pity, just call it grief.
Right. I think that is what I would call it. It's like having a broken arm, having a broken arm and having it in a cast. Well, you can just go on with your broken arm and not get it in a cast and not get it fixed.
Sure.
And that you might pretend like nothing's wrong, but you still have a broken arm and it's not going to set right until you take the time to get that baby healed. And, you know, and that's what I would call it, is that healing process. Don't jump ahead of that. Give yourself time to heal. Yeah. And I've heard another speaker call it self-pity too. And I wondered about it. I thought, I don't know if that's really self-pity. To me, that's really just giving it time to heal.
Well, whatever. The point is that it's facing what
yeah.
we had and
right, the
regretting,
loss yeah.
yeah, or the loss. And it's you know, I'm okay with words like self pity as long as I don't stay in that city very long.
Yeah. Yeah. I just know for me, I just can't even go there. I can't go to that city.
Maybe I
lived there for too long, and so I just can't go back there. I have this thing that I say to God. I like that you said you can't stay in that city. I have this thing I say, that's not my address anymore. Sometimes when I'm tempted to, you know, to go to somewhere that I used to live, like self-pity or maybe deceit or, you know, a different zone, it's like a thought will come, and I was like, oh no, I don't live at that address anymore. I don't need to go there. Yeah.
You have found what works for you. That's what's important.
Right. Now, number seven is, if we want to live a life with no regrets at the end, then we have to take chances now. That's interesting.
Yeah, you know, when I was 22 years old, I remember very clearly meeting a number of people. Some of them were in their late 20s, early 30s. They were always talking about what might have been or what used to be and all that kind of. And I remember thinking very distinctly, I will never regret something at the end of my life. And I decided that I would never come to the end of my life and say, gosh, if only I had. And I promised myself I would never take a job that I didn't really like. And when I discovered I didn't really like it, I would leave it. And that has worked for me. And the best story is my own son was quite musical, and he wanted to join a band, which he did. A lead guitar. He has a nice baritone voice, and he asked me about it. I said, "Sure, take it, go on." I said, "What if you don't like it? You always quit." And he was with it for maybe 3 years, part time, and got to the place where they were really beginning to move ahead. And he left. And he said to me, "Dad, I'm married now. We've got a baby, and I want to spend time with her." And I said, "That's great. That's wonderful." And later on, he said to me, a couple years later, he said, "Something else, Dad." He said, "I'm good, but it wasn't great. And it takes great to really make it in that." And he said, "But, you know, I know now." He said, "I know I couldn't have ever been really outstanding, but I had fun doing it." See, that's what I see life.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it does take courage. Anybody in the Bible who ever accomplished anything, you read their stories, and what is God saying to them right off? Fear not, right?
Yeah.
And why? Why would you need to say that if you aren't taking a chance? If you aren't taking
that's
a chance,
right.
you don't have any fear going on. So I think that that's, you know, pretty consistent through Scripture, that it's going to feel like a big risk when we follow God and do what He's really created us to do. I love that.
Well,
I love that.
May I give you another example?
Yeah.
I was a successful pastor, and I felt God wanted me to write. I knew statistically that only about 2% of people who write books actually make a living at it. But I just felt it was the right thing to do, and I realized that if I didn't do it, I would regret this the rest of my life. So I jumped out. I thought, if I don't make it, I can always become a pastor again, or I used to teach, I can teach. But, you know, God met me. But I took the risk because I was determined never to have regrets.
That's so awesome. Well, I love that. I love that. I know my son had been talking to me one day, and I said, I wish I was more gutsy, you know. And then within 2 days, he watched me do something. He goes, Mom, you are like the gutsiest person I've ever met. So it's all in the definition. I don't do things that, like, I don't like to ride motorcycles or, you know, do all these extreme sports types of things. But in different areas of my life, I'm very gutsy in different ways. And that's all, too. That's all just knowing ourselves and how God created us to be.
Yeah, don't you have a blog radio program?
I do.
Yeah, well, didn't it take some guts to do that?
It did. And actually, you know, a lot of the people that started when I did, Cecil, are no longer here.
Uh-huh.
You know, for whatever reason, it just was too hard. Yeah, it was just too hard or whatever. And it's interesting that whenever I've thought of maybe not being here anymore, it's like, no, this is, it's worth the fight. It's worth the time. It's worth the investment. It's worth it. And then I get to meet people like you, Cecil.
Uh-huh. You're so good at it. You're so good at it, obviously. I don't know your story, but obviously you had to take some kind of risk. I mean, just to expose yourself to a national audience, that is pretty frightening.
Yeah, it could be. Uh-huh.
That's gutsy.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I do so love doing it. I do so love it. Well, let's go on to number 8. Whatever needs aren't met in childhood, we spend the rest of our lives seeking resolution, usually unconscious. I once heard David Smith says that he believes that what happens is when a child is small, that Satan has a demon assigned or however he works that out, and he just makes sure that sometime in a traumatic situation, lies are planted into that child's thoughts. And then he basically leaves him alone and lets him self-destruct. And I think that's kind of what you're saying here, is that we've got stuff from our childhood, from our past, that just eats at us until we get it resolved with Jesus.
Yeah, I would say it quite differently, of course, and I do. But for instance, look, you mentioned I've written more than 100 books. Actually, I've written 120 books. I've got 6-7 more coming out within the next year and a half. Okay, you know what? That's insanity. It really is. No normal person writes that many. But, see, you'd laugh at me. But by the time and editors used to say to me, what drives you? And I would say, I just have a lot of energy, which I do, but that's not the same thing. And about 5 years ago, I realized I was just trying to prove to my father that I was lovable and I was worthwhile. My dad's been dead for years, but there's still that something in me that had to say to Dad, see, Dad, I am worthwhile. My dad was an alcoholic, used to beat me, but I realized that, see, I was still struggling for his love even though he's been dead for years.
What part of it was for your dad?
I'm sorry, I don't understand what you mean.
Well, you said you were driven to write so many books to
prove
to your dad. But which part of it, the writing of so many books, or what
well,
about
just to prove
that?
My self-worth. You know, if you don't feel loved, you will do whatever it takes to get loved.
Mm.
And the only thing I knew to do the driving force was achievement, achievement, achievement. You know, I went to 2 graduate schools full-time. Simultaneously graduated on top of my class. That's insane.
Wow.
Again. I mean, that was a crazy thing. And never realizing why, but it was that silent message that said, see, Dad, I really am worthwhile. I'm worth being loved.
Cecil. Now, okay, but now you've realized that that was your driving force, but you still have 6 books coming out this year, so what's your driving force for that?
Well, now I'm in a lifestyle, and
now
it's okay.
Now all right.
Yeah, it's what my best friend says, it's not what you do, it's the part of you that does it. I think I'm doing it now for my healthy part of me and not from a drivenness.
Sure. Sure. Well, I love that. Well, I don't know. You know, you pointed back to your one of your favorite books to write was in 1992, Gifted Hands. And during that time, you were maybe still being driven by desire to feel worthwhile after your father had, you know, kind of beaten it into you that you weren't. But at that time, and all through that time, God was still using everything you did.
Oh, of course. See, that's what is so beautiful. God overrides these unconscious needs, emotions we have. See, I think God actually uses those, even though they may not be healthy.
Right. Yeah.
If he
had to wait until we were all perfect, then he would never get any work done here.
Yeah. Yeah. You're really good at what you do, and I expect there's some level of drivenness in that. That's not a put down for you, please. It's just you're very talented at what you do, and that's what propels you. And in doing that, I expect there's some unconscious needs in your life that are being met, and that's true as all of us.
I like to just, I think Dan Allender wrote the book, Leading with a Limp. I love that book. And he's just so honest about how every leader, I mean, in really honestly, in order to be a leader, you have to be limping, because that's the kind of people God wants to have be leading, is people who recognize that they've got some issues, they've got some limps, and they don't even know them all. That's one of the, actually for years, Cecil, that was one of the things that made me not want to let God fix something about me that I knew was wrong, is because I knew that as soon as that thing was fixed, he was going to show me something else, something that I was completely oblivious about. And it's like,
well,
I don't want to know.
A lot of people, sure.
I don't want to know. I don't want to know. But, you know, we do want to know, because everything from which he frees us just makes us more free. The sky's bluer, the grass is greener, the birds are beautiful. You know, every bit of freedom that he brings to our lives is so worth the journey to get there.
Absolutely.
Okay, number 9. One major reason for anger is that we don't get what we expect. Well, isn't that the truth? Oh, my goodness.
I mean, so obvious when you think about it. You know,
I know.
Somebody cuts me off in traffic, that's a small thing, but see, I don't expect him to do that, therefore I get angry. Or if I do something, say something really nice to you and you say, drop dead or something like that. See, I would get angry because I was trying to be nice and I didn't get the response from you that I expected. Or, you know, it happens all the time in life because we have a set of expectations and the other person doesn't live with our expectations.
Yeah, I have 3 hated phrases in life, and one of them is unmet expectations. Because instantly you're going along and you're having a happy day and everything's going great, and all of a sudden you're angry, and a lot of times all you have to do is step one step back and look at it and go, which of my expectations were not met right there?
Ooh,
you know?
That's clever. Thank you. I probably steal that.
Oh, my goodness. It's so helpful. And I learned it. I learned it as a teen, actually. And my sister and I came up with the phrase, AYA, analyze your anger.
Ooh,
and when
good.
we would see each other getting really ticked off as a teen, and we had some stuff going on in our home that was difficult, and we'd see each other getting really ticked off, and we'd say, AYA, you know, it's kind of our inside, check it out, step back a second. And usually, Cecil, it was either unmet expectations or else the other one I have is the roses in life where, you know, you had something that was really nice, but then you got pricked by the thorn of it. And it's just like, that's just life. I mean, that's going to happen. And you just have to know, okay, I don't get the rose without the thorns. And you know what they started doing now, Cecil? The flower shops now, they cut the thorns off. Do you know that?
No, I didn't know that. How terrible.
Yes. Just a few years ago, they started doing that, and I think it's too bad, too, because actually, it's such an analogy that we have to remember that with the roses come the thorns, and that's just how God made them. Okay, one last. We give to others what we want to receive. You know, as a parent, have you ever said this to your children? Now, you can't buy her what you want for your birthday. You have to buy her what she wants for her birthday. Did you ever say that to your kids?
I don't think so, but I might have. I probably thought it. But it's true, and we do live that way. We tend to live that way, you know. It hit me one day, probably about 15 years ago. You know, I'm a very open person, and people seem to trust me. And I think one of the things is because I grew up in a very chaotic family, and I didn't know how to trust anybody. And so I unconsciously offer trust and acceptance to other people, which I don't think I got as a kid. That's just one example. I think most of us operate like that, whether we know it or not. Jesus said, do unto others what you'd want them to do unto you. It's a golden rule. I just put my own words.
And I think that, you know, along with our topic today, you know, it says, I think it's in Philippians, but it might be in Peter, where it says that we go through trials so that we have something to offer to other people when they go through it. And a lot of it is, when I went through my trial, I wished that maybe somebody would have done this for me, or someone did do it for me, and I know how valuable it is.
That's right. It's 2 Corinthians 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, see, I was missing on both counts.
Chapter 1, 2, and 3. But it's true, you know. When these things we want, sometimes we give it. But in all honesty, it's something we really want. So if you want, you get somebody you love, and you watch what they do for you and what they give for you, it's unconsciously, I think they may be saying, this is what I want you to do for me.
That's good, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's kind of when they did the five love languages. That's definitely how they told you to decide what your own was, is to see what you were doing. You know, what are you giving to other people? What kind of language are you talking to other people? Because that's what comes naturally to you. That's what you want. That's good. Yeah. That's true in all areas of life. See, so we only have about 2 minutes left. But when you think about the book, Making Sense When Life Doesn't, what is your favorite chapter? What was your most fun part to write, or not necessarily fun?
I like the chapter about struggling for balance, because it was so visual for me. I was at a doctor's office, so this really rather obese man on the scales, and then they asked him to stand on one foot and then the other, and the guy looked like he was taking off ready to fly. And I thought, that's really the way life is. When we start getting on one foot off balance, we're always struggling to balance our life, and it really doesn't work. We can do it for a short time, but life never stays in balance.
Yeah. You say at the end of that chapter, I won't focus on small failures. I'll accept them as tiny steps toward big success.
That's right.
All through the book, you guys, in each chapter he has just, they're very short chapters. This would be a great book to just put in your bathroom, if nowhere else, and just read it. Just, I always say that's, you know, that's a recharge point in my day. I like to just recharge in there with God while I'm, you know, taking care of business. But at the end of each chapter, he just has these great snippets of advice. One is, to make change permanent, I'll focus on small steps that lead to the larger goal. Here's another one. Having the help of an accountability partner means having someone make sense for me when life doesn't. Well, this has been an awesome hour. It's flown by. Cecil, thank you so much for your life, and thank you for joining us today.
You know what? I feel so honored that you'd have me as your guest, Marnie. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. Can't wait to meet you in person here or in eternity. It's going to happen, man.
Who knows?
Okay. Well, you take care and have a good rest of the day.
Thank you. God bless.
Okay, and everybody, if you want to learn more about Cecil, you can visit his website over at cecilmurphy.com. That's cecilmurphey.com. He is the author of a new book called Making Sense When Life Doesn't. You got to get out there and get that one. Also, the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, 90 Minutes in Heaven. And I am going to, because I already have both those books, I'm going to get the book called Gifted Hands from 1992, The Story of Dr. Ben Carson. We've been visiting today with Cecil Murphy, and I'm so glad that you could join us. I hope that you have a wonderful rest of the day and a terrific week. And if you've enjoyed the training here, if you head on over to leadershipattitudes.com, you can get lots more just like it. Have a great day. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.